KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm excited to have on Professor Daniel Margocci of Hunter College, a co-editor of a special volume of the British Journal for the History of Silence on secrecy. Secrecy is a focus of the show increasingly. It's a focus of my own research, but more significantly for purposes of hearsay culture. I think it's an emerging area that intersects concerns about intellectual property, sociology, government operations, democratic theory, political involvement. Obviously, it covers a wide variety of areas. All of us, every human being, has secrets, keeps secrets, wants to know secrets, and so it has that wide berth. In this volume, Daniel and his co-editor, Koen Vermeer, brought together an amazing group of scholars who all write on secrecy, particularly as given the nature of the journal, in the history of science and scientific endeavors. And this is something that we focused on Hearsay Culture a fair amount, and in fact most recently with Professor George Contreras at American, who was on the show discussing his work involving collaborative science and the role of copyright, and how copyright duration in fact impacts sharing among scientific communities. So we continue that discussion, but take a broader sociological and historical view of the issue with our discussion with Daniel today. He co-authored with his co-editor Koen Vermeer an introduction to this volume called States of Secrecy, where he takes a look at the history of scientific secrecy, going back several hundred years, in fact. And as part of that introduction, he interweaves articles written by his co-authors and whom he edited. In the volume, which is in the process of becoming going online through Cambridge University Press. But among the again, terrific collection of authors in this volume includes some former Hearsay Culture guests, including Mario Biagioli, again, his co-author Koen Vermeer, Vera Keller, Stephen Hilgartner, and Peter Gallison, who was on the show not too long ago discussing the documentary that he co-produced entitled Appropriately Secrecy. So we are very lucky to have Daniel on the show today to discuss these issues. Again, secrecy playing an increasing role not just in intellectual property, but more broadly in government operations as well as corporations. We're going to have a pretty wide-ranging discussion focusing more on a theoretical and a historical perspective on the role of secrecy today. By way of a brief background, Daniel is an assistant professor in early modern history at Hunter College in New York, where he focuses on the cultural history of science. He was a postdoctoral fellow at Northwestern University and received his PhD a few years ago from Harvard. And he is joining us via Skype from his home in New York. Daniel, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
Yeah, hi Dave, it's a great pleasure to be on the show and to talk with you.
Let's start off, Daniel, with a question I ask most of my guests. Tell me about the genesis of your interest in secrecy as a focus.
Right, so secrecy became my interest during actually my doctoral research. I'm a historian of early modern science, so I focus on the period between 1500 and 1800, and for various biographical reasons, I study sort of the emergence of modern science in the Dutch Republic during its golden age in the 17th century. And this is a period when the Dutch sort of like, you know, establish their global empire and become a very important player in Europe. One could argue, you know, one of the most powerful states in the 17th century. And my interest was to examine how the global trade that the Dutch initiate, had a real impact on the development of modern science. And so my interest was, you know, how commercialization impacts science, not necessarily just in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, but also a couple of centuries before. And so when I turned to the historical material, I found a lot of phenomena that sound very familiar to us today, such as ghostwriting, commercial competition, and secrecy, most importantly. And it is from this historical research that my more general interest in in secrecy, and especially the role of secrecy in scientific work and research, has developed.
Let me ask you, Daniel, because I'm curious about this. You know, I see secrecy as a field that is emerging, at least in law. And again, it's not that secrecy hasn't been something that obviously has been focused on from a variety of perspectives. But I'm curious to get your perspective from the humanities. Do you see secrecy as a field, as one that's emerging? Is it well defined? Is it not defined? What's your perspective there?
Right, I agree with you. I think it within the humanities as well, secrecy sort of like has been an emerging field, let's say, for the past 20 years or so. And before that, we really didn't talk about issues related to this. But now what you see is that anthropologists, historians, literary scholars are all interested in trying to figure out how secrecy is one of the major concerns of human life, social organization, political behavior, and of course scientific work. So I have definitely seen sort of like a rising interest in the past 10, 15 years in secrecy. Yeah, absolutely, I think.
Yeah, and it's interesting too. I want to maybe again, this is a somewhat abstract and it sounds like an academic question, but I think it's important. You know, you have this relationship between secrecy and privacy. And privacy is something that, again, from the law perspective, of course, is not just an emerging field. I mean, it is a field that is pretty well established. But I'm curious if you have an opinion on it. What you see from, again, your perspective in the humanities is the difference between secrecy on one hand and privacy on the other, if there is one.
Right. Well, let me answer this question sort of like more specifically from my perspective as a historian.
Please.
And I would say that here, originally, historians were mostly interested in just in secrecy and, in fact, less so in privacy. So for I think, many historians and historians of science, the question was, you know, how individuals and, you know, individual scientific practitioners especially, and states, for a variety of reasons, decide to make some certain kinds of knowledge private, yeah? And it is about sort of like how by restricting the flows of knowledge, you know, you are able to establish, you know, political power, gain scientific credit, and or, you know, use it for other purposes. Privacy, you know, is something, you know, that this literature hasn't really discussed for quite a long while, sort of like, you know, why people might have an interest in sort of like keeping certain individual information about themselves to themselves and not discuss for it, you know, with others. So I think privacy has an interest in sort of like certain intimate areas about yourself that you think, you know, you shouldn't really be made into the public. You know, it has been rather a different literature from secrecy as the practice of keeping certain more general kinds of, less intimate kinds of knowledge, you know, from becoming public.
Now let's from that perspective, I think we can get a little bit more detail about what the focus of this journal is. So this special volume of the British Journal for the History of Science focuses on secrecy. You title the introduction, which you co-authored with Koen Vermeer, "States of Secrecy," and perhaps the logical jumping off point is to ask you what that "states of" refers to.
Right. I mean, states of secrecy, I think the title, you know, could have a double meaning. It could refer to the fact, you know, how many states, you know, are actually formed by their reliance on secrecy and how secrecy is a very powerful political tool to regulate populations and to exercise control and to gain an upper hand in military knowledge over other states. But then again, I think our issue is even more interested in saying, you know, that secrecy has many different facets, many different forms, and our issue is teasing out these different forms. How secrecy could be kind of a form of mystery, you know, how, you know, in ancient Greece and other societies, it's basically, you know, rites of initiation are kept secret, you know, and secrecy is in a certain sense, you know, one way to form society by initiating people into secret knowledge. her secrets in the early modern period, again between 1500 and 1800, you know, oftentimes simply meant, you know, practical, useful recipes that could be exchanged. Her secrets, you know, were therefore considered, you know, as useful knowledge that could be helpful for individuals or for the state. Her secrets, nowadays have turned into a category of intellectual property, especially trade secrets, and also her sort of like sociologically speaking, you know, her secrecy is now increasingly the feature of, you know, bureaucracies where basically, you know, established, you know, social hierarchies through the use of secrecy. So really our special issue and its title are trying to show how different uses secrecy can be put into. Yeah.
With regard to this idea of secrecy, I think, I, before I get into a little more detail about the volume itself, last week on the show I had on Professor Hamilton Bean, who teaches at University of Colorado Denver and has written a book on open source intelligence gathering. In his book he quotes a former senior intelligence official as saying a few years ago, his view that in 15 years there would be no more secrets. And recognizing that we're going to turn to the history of this thought in a moment, I'm curious to, in order to contextualize this discussion based upon current issues, what your reaction is to that statement. Do you see secrecy as something which is disappearing literally? And while the statement is somewhat provocative, I'm curious to get your perspective initially on the trends before we move back in time a bit.
I think it is a fascinating quote, that does sound a little bit utopian to me at a moment where actually the classified universe, as one of our authors, Peter Gallison, has pointed out, you know, the classified universe, the amount of information that is withheld from the public, you know, exceeds, by a large amount, you know, the knowledge that is available for the public, and we see every day, you know, sort of like how various, you know, states are withholding and classifying information at an amazing and one could say sometimes alarming rate. So the disappearance of secrecy completely, I would be surprised if it disappeared in the next 15 years, given that it hasn't really disappeared for the past couple of thousand years, so to speak.
Does technology, in your view, or the ability of individuals, and this is the last modern question for a while, does the ability of individuals to actually reveal information unwittingly or easily, depending on your perspective, by virtue of the internet and the flow of information, impact your analysis there?
Right. I mean, I do think the internet and all these technologies are a great way for sharing information and also, of course, for sharing disinformation. So to a certain extent, I think one of the interesting questions, you know, that are emerging in this period, again, I think it's more sort of like an expansion of earlier themes, you know, but maybe at a larger scale, is how the intelligence community and various individuals and states might be interested in sort of like manipulating, you know, such open spheres, both for producing real and unreal information, and in a certain sense, precisely because of this double-edgedness, you know, of new technologies, that everything is available, but we have no idea where these, you know, information, you know, comes from, you know. It will be very much a question not simply of openness and secrecy, but sort of like, you know, believing, you know, what you see or not. And I think, you know, that might be an interesting phenomenon.
We're chatting with Professor Daniel Margocci of Hunter College, a co-editor of a special forthcoming or currently coming out volume of the British Journal of the History of Science on secrecy and its history. Daniel, let's now move back in time a bit to focus on the journal. And I think for those who are wondering how you brought these authors together, it would be useful briefly to give me the background on how this came together.
Right, so this conference, this special issue comes out from a conference that Koen Vermeer, my co-editor and co-author of the introduction, And I organized a few years back at Harvard. I was a graduate student there, and Kuhn was a postdoctoral fellow visiting, I think, at the Radcliffe Institute at that time. And basically, we decided to organize a small conference, a one-day conference on secrecy, with the help of the Kennedy School's program in Science, Technology, and Society, with the funding of and support of Sheila Jasanov and various working groups in Harvard's Department of History of Science. And we gathered together a couple of authors who were at Harvard back then, and we invited a couple of scholars from outside, and our conference, you know, became quite a great success. I wouldn't hesitate to say that. And we decided to publish a select number of the talks in this special issue from that conference back there at Harvard.
Are you and your authors, if you think broadly, making a normative judgment about secrecy, good, bad, to use those words, in this volume, or are you doing more of a historical analysis of its implications, or is
right.
it a little
well,
of both?
As I mentioned, we are interested in the many various facets of secrecy throughout the centuries, and precisely because secrecy is such a multifaceted phenomenon, it is hard for us to say, you know, that we do have a specific normative statement about it, you know, whether secrecy is good or bad. This does not mean that sort of individual authors, including myself, do not have a very strong view on how sort of like some forms of secrecy in current 21st century society can be pernicious or potentially useful. But nonetheless, we say that if you look over the long run, sometimes, you know, secrecy has its problems. At other times, you know, it's a necessary evil. And it does have some positive effects coming up in certain cases, such as, for instance, you know, even, you know, if you are, you know, believing, you know, in open publication, oftentimes while you are working on an experiment or you are writing up an article, you are unwilling to share, you know, bits and pieces of, you know, your upcoming work precisely because they haven't yet been formed. And this kind of incipient secrecy, sort of like not willing to share my results before they are ready, is, you know, oftentimes understandable and might help you finish your work in a timely manner and then publish it in a full-fledged format. So that's one form of secrecy that I think, you know, Mario Biagioli goes into great detail there, how sort of like their secrecy is quite a useful function, you know, facilitating later publications, you know. So Mario Biagioli discusses it in one article in this special issue. But of course, in other cases, you know, secrecy can bring great harms.
You mentioned in the introduction that you co-authored with Kuhn Vermeer, and I'm actually open our focus there on this. What I mentioned to you off air is really, I think, a bibliography of the history of the thought about secrecy in science, but even more broadly. And I intend to. There were many sources there of which I wasn't familiar, and I intend to be reading them over the course of the summer. But let's jump right to the end of your introduction, where you actually lay out a concept of an individual, which I think is a fascinating idea and a way to begin thinking about this history. You use the name or the moniker or the phrase the trickster scientist as a way or a prism through which to think about secrecy in the history of science. So what is the trickster scientist and what is its relevance?
Yeah, right. I think the trickster scientist, which is I think a catchy phrase. Basically, the trickster scientist is an idea to demystify the role of the scientist in our current contemporary and historical culture. I think, you know, we oftentimes have this idea of scientists as these superhuman heroes, but at least some of us do sometimes. Who are working to better society, you know, for, you know, variety of reasons, and who are very much into publishing all their results openly into the public, you know, you know, and then get honorific rewards in exchange for that. You know, they get appointed at a university and they, you know, get various accolades or a Nobel Prize for all their hard work that is for the betterment of science. And our issue, the, and our articles are trying to complicate this simplified picture and to show how, as everyone else, you know, scientists are human beings who are, you know, sometimes acting for the betterment of society, at other times for their private interests, and are wrestling with very serious issues in this process, and are sometimes producing valuable results, at other times unwittingly publish false, you know, scientific results just, you know, by the nature of scientific research. And in some cases, you know, they end up as tricksters, you know, fooling their audiences, you know.
So if we think about this idea of secrecy in the scientific endeavor, there you mentioned in the introduction, and several of the authors talk about explicitly the tension that exists in the scientific community and the question of secrecy. So what is the historic role of secrecy in science?
Right. Well, if I may go back to the historiography a little bit.
Sure.
You know, historians of science and sociologists of science, you know, primarily started to focus on the question of openness much earlier than they were interested in secrecy. And sociologists such as Robert Merton have argued that modern science is basically the success story of openness. And many people have argued in Merton's footsteps that basically, you know, the early modern scientific revolution, the era of Copernicus and Newton, you know, are marked by various incentives that make open publication a norm for scientists. And ever since it has been argued, you know, from the, you know, 17th century onwards at least, you know, scientists, you know, have very powerful interests in publishing their results because that's how they get credit and that's, you know, how they get a position in scientific societies. And in this story, you know, secrecy seems as, you know, something like an aberration. And I think what our issue and our introduction is trying to show that this narrative has its faults, and there are various incentives for scientific practitioners, you know, to actually keep secrets and not to publish their results, or even to say, you know, to partially publish their results. And it is, in fact, you know, if you look at reality as opposed to grand historical narratives, such as Merton's, you find that, you know, it is oftentimes hard to say, you know, whether a certain publication is actually, you know, a piece of evidence for openness or is actually, you know, just, you know, another piece of evidence for secrecy.
When we think about this concept, you mentioned earlier on, and you talk about the primary focus or the scholarly focus, I should say, being on secrecy as either an issue of intellectual property or military advantage. And I'm curious to get your perspective on why you think those two areas have been the primary focus.
Right. I think, you know, the result is, you know, a very tight conceptualization of secrecy. So I think the historiography focuses on these two issues because A, you know, they are our primary concern, and because in both cases, secrets seem to be real. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is that, you know, we oftentimes, you know, can have this idea that secret knowledge is something valuable that gives you an edge over others. And you basically keep secrets because it is in your interest. Yeah. Whether as an individual, you know, you use intellectual property as a way, you know, for gaining sort of like monopoly over a certain field of knowledge and preventing your competitors from catching up with you, or as a state, you know, do exactly the same with your military competitors, other states. And so I think it is this conceptualization of secrecy as basically a form of protecting valuable knowledge that has given so much focus to these two areas. But as I think our introduction argues, You know, this is a very limited conceptualization of secrecy that I think comes up at a very, you know, well-defined historical moment, I would argue. And there are many other uses of secrecy where, in fact, you know, the information you are protecting is, it's not all that important. And it is, in fact, by pretending to have that information that you gain power, you know. So, you know, just to give one very relevant example today, you know, all the information that has now been made available, I think, on WikiLeaks, you know, is still officially secret, yeah? Mm-hmm. And obviously you cannot say, you know, that, you know, this classified information, you know, is not out in the public, you know, but it's more or less, you know, about the state's reaction to sort of like making sure that, you know, things are secret even if everyone knows about them. And it's, I think, you know, very much, you know, a case of posturing, a case of, you know, maintaining the idea of an ordered society and hierarchies, and not acknowledging the fact that, you know, the information, you know, that, you know, one would imagine you keep secret because, you know, it gives you an edge, you know, is no longer giving you an edge because, you know, everyone has downloaded it on their laptops.
We're chatting with Professor Daniel Margucci of Hunter College, co-editor of a special volume of the British Journal for the History of Science on secrecy on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our newly designed webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to the show. So with regard, Daniel, to that last observation, the pretending, if you will, that there are secrets, and this gets into this sociological history here. You know, why would it be, from your perspective, that particularly historically, or in the time period that you focus on, why would it be that one would want to posture or pretend that they have a secret? What's going on there?
Right. Well, let me give you one historical example. I think, you know, I would argue, based on sort of like research that went partly into this special issue, but this also was part of my larger research project. I think, you know, one condition for the emergence of secrecy, you know, as a useful tool for, you know, for posturing in society and for gaining certain advantages, you know, comes up at a moment when you conceptualize scientific knowledge in a certain manner, right? What do I mean by this? I mean, you know, if you understand, you know, knowledge as some sort of, you know, like a bodily, embodied, tacit knowledge, so to speak, yeah, such as, you know, the knowledge of, you know, how you ride a bicycle, you know, a classic example, that is very hard to verbalize, yeah? You know, I cannot, you know, like, you know, tell you now over the radio show, you know, how to ride a bicycle and expect that, you know, you will hop on your bike and will be successful on that, yeah? So if we conceptualize knowledge in such a way, yeah, then really secrecy doesn't make sense, yeah? Because, you know, if you cannot communicate knowledge, if you cannot communicate how to ride a bicycle, you know, there is no incentive for secrecy at all because, you know, really, you know, you cannot communicate, why would you keep it to yourself? You know, why would you spend an effort to keep it to yourself? You know, there is no danger that others will copy what you know. And I think it is a very specific historical moment where we start to begin to believe, yeah, that scientific knowledge can be codified, written down, communicated in very exact verbal language. And I think it's something that comes up in the 17th century, in the age of Newton, where people have this belief, you know, that, you know, whatever you do, whatever, you know, nature does, you can describe in simple mathematical laws that then you can communicate to others, yeah?
You know,
and at that moment, you know, this is the moment where you say, oh my goodness, you know, you know, I can reduce, you know, like gravitation into a couple of mathematical laws, write it down on a piece of paper, and then, you know, publish it, and everyone will understand it, yeah?
Yeah,
at that moment, you might say, okay, that's great, you know, finally I can communicate knowledge. Everyone, you know, will be able to understand what I'm saying and what I'm doing and what I know. And if you are, you know, a little bit entrepreneurial, that is the moment you say, oh my goodness, you know, until then, you know, no one could copy how I ride a bicycle unless, you know, they come and spend a couple of years with me. Or, you know, how I make, you know, pottery, or how I perform alchemical experiments. But now if I can reduce all this knowledge into a couple of, you know, simple mathematical laws, you know, if they come and poach those, you know, mathematical laws, they will be able to copy me. So I think scientific secrecy emerges in this moment of, I think, you know, the late 17th, early 18th century, when, you know, inspired by Newton, everyone starts to believe, you know, whether rightly or wrongly, that, you know, it's enough to communicate your knowledge, you know, on a piece of paper, publish it in a journal, and then, you know, others will be able to copy it. And some will say, you know, okay, let's do it, and others will say, no, 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 I'd better use secrets to prevent, you know, the open circulation of knowledge, which until that moment was practically impossible to do.
You mentioned in the in the introduction, and you talk about the views of some of these individuals and theorists on secrecy, and I'm curious to get you know get your perspective on and if there is evidence suggesting that these particular inventors, the names that we would know today from that period, expressed explicitly the view that sharing of information was necessary. You know, if you think about the inventors that we know of today, is there any evidence of that?
I think there is evidence. So we do have, you know, some authors, you know, who are mentioning, you know, to a great extent, you know, in the 17th and 18th centuries, including Diderot, the famous author and editor of the French Encyclopédie, this great Enlightenment project, you know, who are mentioning that, yes, you know, from now onwards, you know, openness should be the norm, yeah? And at the same time, we see that, you know, much of this, you know, does remain at the level of rhetorics, you know. You know, Diderot is very happy to say that, you know, because he is making money from publishing, you know, scientific information. But he doesn't produce his knowledge, and his interest is, in fact, you know, making money from publishing the knowledge of others. So what we see is that there is a certain rhetorics, you know, going on, you know, that, yes, we should publish everything. But in practice, again, what I see is many of the actual inventors and the scientific practitioners who do the hard work are saying that, you know what, I need to earn a living, and if I publish everything openly, you know, it will not work. So many of the authors will explicitly say that, you know, I will only reveal, you know, what I know, you know, the inventors of color printing, the inventors of, you know, preservation techniques in anatomy, and in many fields, you know, they will say, you know, once you pay me, I might make my knowledge public, you know. If you give me a privilege, I might make my knowledge public. And in the 18th century, they will say, if you give me a patent, yeah, you know, which is something that is emerging in the 18th century, concept of a patent, you know, then I will share my knowledge with you and you can publish it in a couple of years. But until then, you know, let me make money, you know, during the term of the patent, you know, just on my own. So I think, you know, there is a rhetoric of openness going on, oftentimes from people who are not the producers of knowledge. And then there are many producers of knowledge who say, yeah, openness is a great idea, but I do need to make money first.
Which I have Professor Daniel Margucci of Hunter College, a co-editor of a special volume of the British Journal of History of Science on secrecy on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Daniel, this conversation, of course, and you've alluded to it here, and it's an area of particular interest of mine, and we haven't focused on as much as I would like, in fact, on hearsay culture, is trade secrecy, and commercial secrecy. And you know, we have, now, a well-developed, body of law in trade secrecy. Trade secrecy, however, is a common law concept, and the cases that deal with trade secrecy, at least from the U.S. perspective, really only go back to the early or mid-19th century. But, of course, you talk about commercial secrecy as going back far further than that. Where does trade secrecy, in your view, fall into the equation as we think about the history of secrecy in science?
Right, yes. So I do think, just at the danger of repeating myself a little bit, yeah, that trade secrecy really emerges, you know, during, you know, the scientific revolution, where many people would argue modern science itself develops, you know, that's why we focus on the scientific revolution, if we do, because we claim there is some sort of a continuity from that moment onwards, yeah. You know, when you have a belief in the communicability of scientific knowledge, yeah, and I think, you know, that historically, before that, you know, before the 17th century, secrecy is about controlling the movement of people, and especially your apprentices, yeah? Before the 17th century, much of knowledge gets transmitted by training in the workshop with an artisan, you know, and there, you know, and not through, you know, learning things from the journals or textbooks, yeah? And so in that period, you know, secrecy is not really trade secrecy in our modern sense, but before the 17th century, it is really about, you know, how I make sure that my apprentices, you know, will not set up shop somewhere else, how I can control their movement, and how I can restrict what they learn in the workshop where I am the master. And then in the course of the 17th century, trade secrets develop as this concept of, you know, protecting the circulation of knowledge and information as opposed to the circulation of people who have been associated with me. And from then onwards, you know, trade secrecy is emerging together with intellectual property, but in a certain sense, you know, seems like the first, you know, manner of choice. And even when you seem to be, you know, publishing openly, it turns out that you are trade secret. So if you look at early journal publications in the 17th and 18th centuries, yeah, you know, where scientific journals appear for the first time, you might think, you know, that these journal publications are a proof of openness, yeah, you know, that they are showing, you know, how science is becoming modern, yeah, how it's becoming academic, where, you know, you just read in a newspaper, you know, what is important. But then you look at the articles and you see, you know, many of those articles are telling you the results of, you know, what the scientist has discovered, not telling you how the scientist came there, and are basically telling you, you know, I have some great inventions that you might be interested in buying. And much of the contents of the journal that you expected to be real scientific articles are basically advertisements, yeah? So what you seem to think is open knowledge is oftentimes, you know, a partial publication of results in order to, you know, give you sort of like a little bit of a teaser as to what you can really buy privately, you know, sort of like what is still kept as a trade secret.
Yeah, we think about trade secrecy as being protected by law versus as controlling the mobility of labor. I'm curious to get your, if you have a perspective on it, when trade secrecy as a legal doctrine entered the forefront. Yeah, because certainly, if we think about controlling apprentices or impacting the mobility of labor, that is clearly one of the major impacts of trade secrecy as a legal doctrine today, which is why there's so much overlap with employment law. But I'm curious if you have respect on it, at what point this became not just a general doctrine of commercial behavior, but something that the law itself indicated was of value enough to protect as an interest?
Right, that is a very interesting question, and I can only give you a partial answer because I'm not really a historian of the law.
I understand.
But it is very clear, I think, from very early onwards that sort of like, you know, legal doctrines about controlling the movement of people, of artisans, are present from the late Middle Ages onwards, so even before 1500, you see how guilds in the various cities, you know, these corporations of artisans working in a certain professions, yeah, how these guilds, you know, are very much stating, you know, like, what are the you know, and cities are stating, you know, what are the regulations for letting apprentices leave our city, go to other places, and also in converse, you know, to trade secrecy, what are the legal opportunities for us to give incentives for other artisans from other places to move to our city to improve the economy. So for controlling people, you know, there is a long movement of people and the knowledge associated people, there is a very long legal tradition. When it comes to controlling the circulation of knowledge, I think it is interesting to emphasize, yeah, that the earliest cases of what we could call nowadays as patent law, yeah, are privileges, yeah, giving, you know, sort of like a privilege, you know, a king or, you know, a state or a city, giving a privilege to an inventor, you know, to practice, you know, really in monopoly circumstances, a certain technique, technology or enterprise within a certain area. And there what you see that, you know, these privileges, you know, were kind of like trade secrets and less so, you know, than patents because you do not have that important feature of patent law that you actually have to disclose what you are practicing. So the earliest cases of privileges, you know, what we nowadays call the predecessors of patent law, and Mario Biagioli has done a lot of research on this, you know, they really basically say, you know, we will give you, you know, the right to practice whatever you do as an inventor in this area for a long time period, but we do not want you to share this knowledge with us necessarily. Yeah.
Which I have Professor Daniel Margucci on Hearsay Culture, KZSU-FM Stanford. Daniel, I'm at the point in the show where we have about 10 minutes left or so, and I start asking what I call the unfair questions, the questions that you may not have enough time to answer as much as you would like, but hopefully I can phrase them in a way that they become slightly less fair. But I think this is going to fairly be an unfair question, if you pardon the pun. You mentioned a sociologist whose work, at least from again, my perspective, but again, I'm viewing this from someone who teaches law, is under-recognized and not as focused on today as one would think, and that's a German sociologist, Georg Simmel, who has written amazing analyses of secrecy. You quote him as saying that secrecy was, according to him, one of the greatest accomplishments of humanity and a necessary element of human society. And you discuss his work under the subheading From Secrets to Secrecy. And so I'm curious to get your perspective, and certainly for the benefit of listeners, is Georg's work, how valuable is Georg's work today in thinking about secrecy, particularly post September 11th, which is something you talk about in the article?
Right. Thank you. Let me then be brief and give an unfair amount of time and attention
yes.
to this great sociologist.
Yes.
So indeed, I think what our introduction to this special issue is trying to do is both to provide a historiographical review of, you know, what has been done in the history of science on secrecy, and indeed, you know, what we have just discussed, the histories of openness, trade secrets, and IP law, and also to bring in new perspectives. And Simmel is such a great inspiration for us, and I think for many people in the humanities, although not necessarily in the history of science so far, is because he is arguing that secrecy is not just about protecting important knowledge, but it is a way of organizing society, right? The secrecy is ultimately a sociological phenomenon where, regardless of the content of the knowledge that we have and are unwilling to share, yeah, whether it's something that everyone knows but we refuse to acknowledge it, whether it is something, you know, that no one is interested in, you know, let's say, you know, the two sides of my grandfather, yeah, or whether, you know, the recipe for the age bomb, yeah? Regardless of what the content of knowledge is, just by making it secret and sharing it among a select group of people, that group will, you know, develop bonding, so to speak, yeah? So that secrecy allows to develop societies, you know, form groups and develop bonding, yeah? That gives a certain kind of, you know, organization, a feel of, you know, we all are in this together, yeah? And we argue that much of what goes under the name of, you know, trade secrets or political secrets or military secrets, you know, is not really about protecting valuable knowledge, but really is about sort of like maintaining, you know, the group or organization that we are part of, you know. And again, you know, in our post 9/11 world, you know, one could, you know, ask the question, you know, and I do not necessarily have a definite answer to that, is, you know, the explosion of secrecy and classified knowledge, you know, that is going on in the United States especially, is this really about protecting, you know, our people? Is this about, you know, protecting valuable information? Or is this a way, you know, for justifying the existence of all these hierarchical organizations, you know, and secret agencies, you know, that basically, you know, justify their existence both to the public and I think both to themselves, you know, by saying, you know, that the knowledge we have is valuable and should not be shared with others, you know. And it's hard to say because we just don't know what they know, right? You know, to say whether it is valuable knowledge or not. And one does have sometimes a suspicion, you know, that it is in a certain sense, you know, a great, you know, sociological tool for them to maintain their organization. Yeah.
In the remaining few minutes that we have, Daniel, a couple more questions, and it ties into that to the theme of our discussion since the break, which is commercialization, broadly speaking. Is it a fair statement in your view, based upon a history, to say as an if-then statement, that if there is commercialization, it will inevitably lead to more secrecy in science. Is that a fair tautological statement?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, and I think it depends on what you mean by secrecy, right? If secrecy, you know, as we just discussed, you know, is a sociological phenomenon, you know, which is not about the value of the knowledge, you know, but really sort of like, you know, keeping the organization together, then in that respect, you know, commercialization doesn't necessarily make such a big difference, you know. You know, let's give the example of, you know, the USSR. In the Soviet Union, there was a lot of secrecy, both regarding to scientific knowledge, yet, you know, one would be hard put to say, you know, that, you know, the Soviet Union was a capitalist, you know, commercialized society, yeah. At the same time, if you consider, you know, secrecy as, you know, the protection of valuable knowledge, you know, for your particular purposes, then, you know, I think, you know, my own research, you know, is showing, you know, that commercialization does increase the value of secrets, you know. And what I would argue here, you know, is that take a long view of commercialization, yeah? It doesn't start with the Bayh-Dole Act in the 1980s.
Right.
It doesn't start, you know, with the rise of biotech. You know, my own work, you know, claims, you know, that it starts with the Dutch Golden Age, you know, when global trade explodes. And others would say, you know, it starts with the Italian Renaissance. And others would say, you know, that commercialization has been with us for all. But definitely, you know, trade secrets and interest in you know, protecting your valuable knowledge for your private interests, you know, might, you know, get a boost from commercialization. Yes.
We're finishing up our discussion with Professor Daniel Margocci of Hunter College. Daniel, I was, you know, I as you were talking about these issues, I was thinking about again a former guest on the show, Sarah Rose, who wrote a more of a popular history of tea trade in China through the Dutch East India Company, called For All the Tea in China, which is, although she writes it as more of an adventure story than a study of trade secret law, but clearly clearly the way that the Chinese attempted to treat literally the tea plants were as trade secrets. And in closing, as we think about these issues, I'm curious to get your perspective on that concept. I mean, if we have this long history of secrecy in science, of control, and we have it going up against this tension for sharing, for openness that, is, as I think, brought to fore, or at least become more present for more people as a result of technology, what can we learn from the history that you and your colleagues have written about that would be useful today as we think about secrecy from a policy perspective?
Right. I think, historians are often hard put, to say, what to do with the policy question. I think, one answer that, one would say is, don't think that this is a new problem that you can fix simply and clearly, whether with a new doctrine, or some the establishment of some new laws, because, as we all know, whenever you establish, some sort of like a legal regulation, there immediately spring up a lot of different ways to evade, avoid, or play with those regulations. So I think, going back, what you mentioned about the tea trade, and going back in history, we see that, for a very long time, for a long centuries, trade secrecy have been with us, yeah. And one would say, that of course, sometimes these have been terribly, leading to terrible results, The Dutch East India Company, that played in such an important role in getting tea out of the hands of the Chinese, was a very secretive corporation, yeah, that censored books, that delayed the publication of books with 40 years, when it concerned, the production of various colonial spices in the East Indies, and especially how the Dutch were treating indigenous populations, not surprisingly, terribly. So, yeah. But then, one would argue that, at the same time, it is this very period that gives rise, many argue, to the rise of modern science. So terrible as commercialization was, and deplorable it was, some people say, yes, at the same time, also many results, were achieved, with the help of secrecy, that had some beneficial effects. And I'm not necessarily always in agreement with such claims, but we do have to realize that commercialization and secrecy, are double-edged concepts that are sometimes terrible and have pernicious effects, but without them, maybe modern science wouldn't have developed the way it had, and whether that's a good or bad thing, I leave it for others to decide.
Professor Daniel Margocci of Hunter College, co-editor of a forthcoming, and I keep saying forthcoming, journal of the British Journal of History of Science, but let's be clear. Many of the articles are online, and we are recording the show on May 1st. As far as public access to all of the articles, that should be occurring over the next few weeks. But in the interim, Daniel, I want to thank you for joining us on the show today, for having this discussion, and I certainly invite you back to continue this discussion, because obviously secrecy is only increasing in importance, and understanding the sociological history of secrecy, I think, is key to understanding where we should go. So thank you for joining us today on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to mention a number of guests coming up on Hearsay Culture. Next week, Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law, regarding her article, Illuminating Innovation. Following that, Baron Zoka of Tech Freedom, co-editor of the book, The Next Digital Decade. Christopher Segoia and Stephanie K. Pell, co-authors of Can You See Me Now? Towards Reasonable Standards for Law Enforcement Access to Location Data That Congress Could Enact. Marvin Amori, author of First Amendment Architecture. Professor Brett Fishman of Cardozo Law, author of the book Infrastructure, The Social Value of Shared Resources, and Professors Woody Hartzog and Fred Stutzman of UNC, a PhD student, are going to be on as well talking about their work. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can email me for any comments, questions, feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. This quarter, you can listen to the show live Tuesdays, 3 p.m., and so this show is actually airing on the day that it's recorded, which is ideal. But you can listen to the show on KZSU Live at 3 p.m. Tuesdays, or you can get the show via podcast by going to either hearsayculture.com, which I am finally now this week in the process of updating, as I've mentioned previously. It's been an exceptionally busy but good year. And I'm not sure if I even mentioned this on air, but in March, I was promoted to associate professor and tenured at Elon University. I'm very proud and excited at that vote of confidence from my colleagues, and I look forward to continuing my work there. But that made for a very busy year where I was not able to devote as much time as I would have liked to Hearsay Culture. That having passed, I will be focusing more on Hearsay Culture, although producing my own scholarship and work. But what that means is I'll have a more regular schedule, and I appreciate the listeners' patience over the last several months as I was focusing more directly on the various things that one needs to do to make sure that their careers move forward. And, of course, that intersects nicely with the work I do anyway, so that was all good. But that's done. So I will be looking forward to a more regular schedule on a going-forward basis, and you can get that schedule by going to hearsayculture.com. You can listen to the show via podcast at hearsayculture.com or by going to the Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going indeed to the Stanford CIS iTunes page, where you can get all previous events occurring at CIS in addition to Hearsay Culture. Thank you for joining us today on the show. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more terrific programming, and have a great day.